Hi guys, before we start, I just wanted to say thank you to everybody for helping us get to 1,000 subscribers over on Substack. This piece was made free because of that milestone, and also this reading is part of our 1,000 Substack subscriber celebration. So thanks everybody, and if you want to see and hear more of these, do go over and subscribe to Anti-Politics on Substack. Pub Praxis, demystifying dissident action. Originally pitched but not performed as a speech at the 2022 Witten event. The theme of the event was Logos versus Praxis. The coalescence of a group identity is key to forming any movement, but for one based around a counter-regime traditionalism that is deliberately and radically dissident, it is at the top of the priorities list. Without an idea of who we are and what we want, there is no moving forward. These ideas, I believe, are coalescing as we've heard a somewhat cohesive set of talks based around shared ideas and ideals in the past. This is encouraging, but there is, partly by design, a large barrier to entry to interface with those ideas. There is no bottom rung or thin end of the wedge that is not in some way steeped in the ideas of our ideological enemies or the ruling elite. This is not a populist movement. Indeed, it rejects the very notion of functional change through populism. But it is one that must secure the action and inaction of certain groups if it wants to find a path to real power. The most neglected aspect of that pathway is the function of what de Juvenel referred to as the periphery. The low, those who are totally shut out of the power process, and with whom those wishing to gain power can make a powerful alliance. As the philosopher and historian David Hume points out, the many are always governed by the few. This is not done by raw force, which numerically is always on the side of the governed, but by belief in legitimacy of that governance to some degree. We may not seek electoral power, but how do we gain a level of basic legitimacy in the eyes of the masses? The answer I and many others have come upon is to posit ourselves as the true heirs of Britain's ideas and ideals and draw on its long history to show the illegitimacy of the current order in regard to the basic principles of Britishness and the people that make up the population of Britain that is native. I spoke in my last essay last year of drawing on the long, diluted spirit of the British liberal tradition as an antidote to modern mass democracy, a tradition that is radically proprietarian, steeped in older traditions, and wholly incompatible with the modern conception of liberalism. Those ideas of freedom and property still have some remnants in the modern world and can serve as a starting point to draw on a deep ocean of native British ideas and identity consisting of thousands of years of pre-modern concepts. I do not believe we are so degraded, so uprooted and deracinated, that the ancient spirit of these isles is lost. To quote that previous essay, the rights of an Englishman to build his shelter, till the earth, raise a family as he sees fit, defend his property, praise his God, and be unmolested by those who would consider themselves his betters, goes back long before Locke's homesteading principle and into the mists of Albion. Getting those ideas to at least a section of the masses in a form they can readily understand is vitally important. There is a whole slew of the British population that is primed to be receptive to these ideas, an ember of Albion that still burns within them. It can once again grow into a flame if only we can parse our ideas in the correct terms. But in order to get there, we must first take a trip to the pub. Chapter 1. The Power of the Pub. Nowhere do the remnants of Britain long past bubble to the surface more than in the local pubs. They are whispered in dark corners of the King's Arms, and then perhaps even shouted in a slurred fashion after a few more pints. There are no content moderators in the pub, and the bouncer isn't interested that you said a no-no word in confidence to a friend. He has real problems to deal with. Junkies, drug dealers, and God forbid, hen parties. He's a working man like the rest of the punters. The local pub is an institution, and it is the closest thing to time travel you can do in Britain. Sometimes almost literally, with many suffering pubs ill-equipped to afford a major refit since the 1980s. In areas where a community still clings to life, it is the singular informal meeting point for extended conversation between members of that community, and therefore a place ripe for discussion unmoderated by the power structure, inexorably leading to dissent. For that reason, I believe the war on the local pub is no accident. Its decline has been excused as being good for the health of the nation. With panics around binge drinking and the patronising indoor smoking ban taking their toll on the pub, along with minimum unit pricing, higher alcohol taxes, higher alcohol production costs, and a general anti-small business environment chipping away at the local pubs in the UK, especially the independent ones. Here in the UK, we have lost almost 14,000 of our pubs. That's a full 22% between 2000 and 2019. That's even more dramatic when you consider the population has increased by around 14% in that same time period. This is even before we factor in the onslaught of the lockdowns and the current needless, suicidal inflation spiral. Nothing shows a town or city in decline like a closed or converted pub. I find it a mournful sight that inspires genuine sadness in me. If I routinely wore a flat cap like my Lancashire forebears, I remove it in solemn reverence. I mourn not just because of my personal enjoyment of the pub as an institution, but because their disappearance represents a shrinking of the spirit of dissent and the localist world they carry. I do not wish to repeat myself too much, so I will once again draw on my previous work. This is once again a quote from my 2021 speech at the Witan, which was entitled Deprogramming British Democracy. To quote, one heartening factor is that, in my experience, there is a dormant desire for the ideas precisely of this type with the British public. There is a constant thread of man-in-the-pub politics, which runs counter to the prevailing narrative. The elite strata may control mass media, but they have never convinced the man in the pub. He is committed to his family and his community before any layer of state ideology. It is often said that the average British man is far more nationalistic than our current leaders are. But this is a misreading. His instinct is far more localistic. Millwall localism supersedes biscuit tin nationalism. This commitment to town as tribe is a source of great derision within the managerial strata of society. It is seen as the apex of vulgar gammon behaviour. Polling done by the regime themselves bear this out, as does their own propaganda. There is much hand-wringing over the dangers of English nationalism, or the anti-immigrant sentiment of the lower classes. There is an obsession with what is put forward as the moral health of our nation, with the working class imbued with undesirable ideas akin to a disease in the eyes of the ruling class. But you shouldn't need to look at the polling. It's obvious. You can go down to the pub and ask people yourself. As we talk about these concepts from a bird's eye view, it's important to understand that this is a phenomenon made up of individuals who experience the boot of the current order from which we can truly be seen as liberators. These shared experiences build up into a sort of British working class consciousness. Chapter 2. Big Baz, the Lumpen Proletariat. There is an inbuilt aversion within right-wing circles to talking about class, and especially class consciousness, in a serious manner. Class as a political reality is seen as an affectation of Marxist thought, in the same way the liberal centrist has been trained to desire a colourblind society and tuts disapprovingly at those who see race as an immutable reality. So too is class seen as a remnant of the dark, non-egalitarian past, to be flattened and extinguished in service of an atomised, sovereign individual. Strides have been made in identifying and reckoning with the elite class and the managerial class as groups who act with a clear class consciousness and shared purpose. But little attention has been paid to the British working class. If we are to be guardians of hierarchy and order, the staunch anti-egalitarians, that instilling the correct logos within the average British working man is of vital importance. Widespread as though it may be, the man-in-the-pub politics of the working class is something that, when expressed publicly, is used to mark individuals out as firm enemies to be dehumanised and disregarded. Within Marxist theory itself, we see a key get-out clause reserved for class traitors within the otherwise heroic proletariat. To quote, Lumpenproletariat, German, rabble proletariat. According to Karl Marx in the Communist Manifesto, the lowest stratum of the industrial working class, the members of the Lumpenproletariat, this social scum, said Marx, are not only disinclined to participate in revolutionary activities with their rightful brethren, the proletariat, but also tend to act as bribed tools of reactionary intrigue. That's a quote just directly from Encyclopedia Britannica, signalling the lumpenproletariat status of what is now a measurable majority of the working class is a very prominent feature of modern British politics. These are the gamins, who en masse suddenly vote the wrong way or believe the wrong things, much to the regime's chagrin. The key here is not their lowly or outsider status, but their unwillingness to engage in class struggle, and in many modern usages of the term, simply apolitical or non-leftist working class, are considered lumpenproletariat. Despite the readiness of traditional and modern leftists to recruit from and venerate the ranks of the criminal class, they use a natural reactionary impulse of disgust at base criminality to conflate their working class opponents with that section of the social order. Right-wing ideas are deliberately made to be low status. As Paul Gottfried points out in The Strange Death of Marxism, The European Left in the New Millennium, genuine revolutionary Marxism in the traditional sense has been completely abandoned by the ruling elite, as their perceived status from insurgent to managerial class has been solidified. They wear Marxist trappings like a skin suit, and utilise it cynically and pragmatically to their own ends, but nowhere more cynically than in regards to the British working class. As presented in other essays at past events, the modern managerial class see the working poor as mere livestock. Their efforts focus on keeping them free of disease and able to fulfil their functions within the social order and ever more complex societal systems. This is why we see focus on national health and herd immunity, along with the aforementioned binge drinking excuse to give the local pubs another kicking. These are a prime example of another of Gottfried's salient subjects, the therapeutic state, which aims to meddle and medicate all dissident feelings away, seeing it as a form of mental illness. Rather than delve into why the man in the pub finds his reality so repugnant that he wants to blot it out with 15 pints, they simply seek to tax the pint more so he can only afford 10. Thomas Carlyle, in his writings, quite humorously makes use of personified broad stereotypes of Englishmen to make his point. The William the Woodturners of his age make his essays more grounded and give a sense of time and place to his words. Some of you may be aware of the North FC memes and their strangely endearing portrait of the northern working class. He is, quite literally, lumpen in their imagery, like a great stubbly potato, body-wide and football shirt clad. He is a loving caricature in almost Victorian John Bull style, and his understanding of the predicament of modernity is one that is purely intuitive and instinctive. Love me pint, love me footy, ate them illegal immigrants, just don't like them, simple as. His is a world where that is the extent of logos needed, where right is right and wrong is wrong. Praxis and logos are needlessly fancy words for the world of the local pubs. In many ways, his intuitive understanding is more pure, less corrupted by having to talk yourself into the obvious solution. Clear them out. Big Baz is a fiction, a thought exercise, but he embodies a spirit that disquiets the establishment deeply. Images of large, tattooed, gammon-faced men amassing to make themselves heard and felt completely outside of the control of the traditional political forces makes the effeminate public schoolboys of the Whitehall Mandarin class quake and sweat with genuine fear. This is why so much attention is paid to vilifying the reactionary working class in a way distant intellectuals or those with a higher social status are not subjected to. This is because those people are more easily bribed and bullied, they have more to lose, and they are inculcated enough within the system to know where they can make gain through compromise and concession. Big Baz is less easy to deal with. His anger is not intellectualized, but it is raw and vital, and he is much harder to purchase and control. Chapter 3. The Most Hated Men in Britain. This is why, for example, even a stooge like Tommy Robinson was performatively put in prison, but someone like Peter Hitchens was not. This is why Kevin Kieran was effectively murdered by the British state for the crime of putting a piece of bacon on a mosque door handle. And paedophile serial rapist Qurban Ali is now once again free to walk the streets of Rotherham. The right-wing working-class man of action is the most hated form of dissident. And when the establishment signals, through both stated and revealed preference, that something scares them, you should take notice. Groups such as Robinson's former English Defence League embody, albeit clumsily, a genuine groundswell of feeling. There have been dozens of these groups, movements and political parties throughout the years that have tried to embody the spirit of rightward working-class dissidents, but none of them have found real allies within the establishment, or secondary power centres, and none really had the intellectual or disaffected elite vanguard behind them, and above them to keep them both cohesive and focused. And you need both sides of this equation if you are not to merely fizzle out. Largely because earnest grassroots working class action is the most heavily targeted by both police and intelligence services. The men who make up these movements are imprisoned and bullied into situations of compromise, often becoming agents of the security state itself, and this is what I believe happened with Tommy Robinson. This is a function of the current elite's hegemony, and even in the political mainstream, instincts of working class dissidents are signalled as low status and morally wrong. Much was made in the past of the crumbling of the Red Wall in British politics, with the media dutifully falling back to calling the native working class of Britain all the signifiers of the modern lumpen proletariat, the gammon discourse. This right with dissidents is a subject for mainstream debate, but so far it has only seen controlled outlets with which to express itself. Despite being great in number, the supposed egalitarians of the modern British state have ruthlessly suppressed the presence of any native working class within the governing elite strata. I spoke about this very phenomenon in a previous speech I presented at Nomos Birmingham, also in 2022. The speech was called Where Are the Elites? And it is over on the Substack if you do want to go and read it. But to quote, males who excel without the conniving traits that would allow them to dishonestly integrate into the modern education system are the very definition of what Prato dubbed the lions. Natural elites who favour strength, bravery, and honesty above the purely intellectual. What we would have previously thought of as a warrior class. Preventing these individuals emerging from circles not already subsumed in the elite structure is of extraordinary benefit to the current elite, as they constitute the most dangerous potential threat to them. End quote. What I did not have the time or space to elucidate on fully during that presentation is that these lions are overwhelmingly working class men who are driven to work in practical or manual fields. Many working class men have better financial means than their supposedly middle class office-bound contemporaries. As good plumbers, roofers, fitters, joiners, plasterers, builders, etc. can command a very high premium and often grow to employ multiple people. They are Nonetheless, shut out of the managerial process, even though the self-employed small owner operators are those who feel the brunt of the bureaucratic state most keenly, neatly demonstrated again by their treatment during the lockdowns. This is because the regime would not survive their integration into the ruling class in its current form. They are fundamentally incompatible with it because they are people who are able to get things done. Samuel T. Francis, in his posthumously published magnum opus, Leviathan and Its Enemies, points out the link between the intolerant views of the working class and their exclusion from the managerial ruling class. Quoting Seymour Martin Lipset in 1960, he says, to quote, "Public opinion data from a number of countries indicate that the lower classes are much less committed to democracy as a political system than the urban middle and the upper classes," end quote. Those with ideas and skills that do not fit into the rigid social expectations of the current ruling order are kept on the periphery, no matter how much competence they demonstrate. This is why you can have absurdities like working class millionaires. Aforementioned non-technocrat business owners are still shut out of the power structure, no matter how much wealth they accrue. Working class in Britain is no longer simply an economic signifier, but a deep cultural and political one too. Prato, in his theories, predicted this polarization of the social order between the ruling and non-ruling elite, and it forms the basis for his theory of the circulation of elites and ideas of social revolution. This is why both Prato and Francis posit that the causal relationship between anti-regime ideas and lower societal status is reversed from how we are taught to see it. These people are not intolerant because they are relegated to what is perceived as a lower class. They are relegated to a lower class because they have counter-regime ideas. This is why the ultimate bad guy in a modern society is some flavour of racist or fascist. Potential lion elites abound in this abandoned class, natural leaders that are incompatible with the current order. We cannot afford to ignore them if we wish to make headway. The issue is, once again, forging a bridge to those people who have been systematically walled off from each other and elites who may share their ideals. Chapter 4. Containment and Control. Jonathan Bowden made most of his speeches in pubs for a good reason. He was one of the few men of Logos in the 21st century who could communicate readily with the disaffected working class in Britain, and often did so face to face. The pub really is the only readily accessible non-digital space where these ideas can be talked about. And as such, in times of imposed crisis, as a movement, we must strive to keep those community places open and full of conversation, preferably our conversation. The pub, of course, is simply short for public house, a concept reflecting that these places mostly started as people's homes open to the drinking public. There are some heartening hints of a speakeasy culture that developed during the lockdowns. Dissident speakeasies in times of crisis and persecution are an excellent idea, and we should keep them at the front of our minds. I will give a shout out to the Cathedral Project, that is actually restarting again, by the way, I'll link to that below, run by the London Basket Weavers, as a real-world example of this, being a dissident pop-up club. Jonathan Bowden exists firmly in a beyond-the-pale area of British politics because of his activism with the British National Party. Even within current dissident circles, you would find more people who proudly displayed copies of Sir Oswald Mosley's The Alternative than who would openly admit they had supported the BNP at one time or another. Within the mass media, the BNP functioned as a working-class zoo for journalists to poke and prod at caged examples of working-class rage. Its continual public humiliation ended up as a cautionary political tale about why you don't listen to the scum, and why the working class would do best to keep their reactionary thoughts to themselves, lest they suffer the same fate. The BNP was a caricature of the lumpen proletariat, used to sully the idea of any outlet of working class, dissident right-wing feeling at the height of the Blair regime. There could be no party to the right of the Tories during this time, as it would allow a shift of where the centre ground was located. Once the Tories were back in power, though, this building rage needed a controlled outlet. Nigel Farage and UKIP emerged as a more palatable, emasculated version of what the BNP had become in the Nick Griffin years, due to its attempt to exist within the political system. UKIP, through stabbing at the BNP, gained large, widespread dissident working class support, acting as a lightning rod for those who opposed mass immigration and the wholesale abolition of their birth nation into an EU superstate. I'm convinced a large part of the success of UKIP was simply down to the fact Nigel Farage looked comfortable holding a pint, whereas most politicians looked like alien robots when they tried to so much as eat a sandwich. His big bloke-in-the-pub energy and single-issue message made him the perfect soundbite machine for big bazzes the country over. This mass support culminated in one of the most written-about events of post-war British politics, Brexit, the supposed routing of the establishment by the lumpen proletariat Brexiteer scum. Seen in retrospect, the Brexit referendum was in fact a disaster for the non-establishment British right, as the effective disbanding of UKIP and its aftermath meant all that pent-up working-class rage over a whole slew of subjects could effectively be dissipated into a sea of wannabe successor parties, with most of the Brexiteers folded back into the Tory party, with Boris Johnson their great blonde hope. Brexit and the collapse of UKIP functioned as the most effective method to reintegrate those who had shifted into a soft, dissident space back into the party political mainstream, especially those of working class background. I was a bit gentle on Nigel Farage here, kind of implying that he was meant to be the successful and palatable face in the wake of the decline of the BNP. But with his latest actions and with his continuing role as a lightning rod for energy to dissipate, I will say once again that yes, Nigel Farage is one of the most destructive enemies that the British right has, and he should be, in all cases, repudiated. UKIP never had what Jonathan Bowden wanted British right-wing politics to have, a genuinely radical revolutionary spirit. Working-class British identity in the media is still tied to the ghost of Arthur Scargill, the myth of leftward revolutionary action against the evil tyrant Maggie Thatcher, the milk snatcher. In reality, Scargill ended up being seen as a disgrace within the union movement after attempts to sell the UK out to the Soviet Union for personal gain. But his myth is still lionized by the establishment order as he represents action that is wholly captured by the establishment. The Labour movement he so violently fought for is the same movement whose elected MPs allowed mass immigration into those same northern mining communities. You can draw a straight line between blood on the picket lines and Islamic rape gangs, but even this admission of reality is something no major UK political party would dare do. Chapter 5. The Unspeakable. At some point, if a dissident movement is to be successful, it must reckon with some level of recognition. The message we have is a powerful one, a resonant one, and one which simply needs articulating to people who already know it implicitly. Part of what must be done is creating messaging and outreach that can build a bridge to that section of the populace. Baz evangelism. I speak again not of building a mass bottom-up movement, of course, but in order to start becoming a power centre, we need to start thinking like one. The British working class man is an ideal peripheral figure to ally with once the central vanguard has been formed. As discussed earlier, those of a ruling temperament that do not fit with the conniving managerial foxes, as Prato described, are cast out into the political and social wilderness, where they are primed for our message and well equipped to be of help. Speaking of the socialism and Marxism of the 1950s, Peter Hitchens had this to say in The Abolition of Britain, to quote, "More modern divisions over social or sexual attitudes were simply not reflected in the left-right split. Working-class socialists were likely to be less sympathetic to homosexuality, more opposed to abortion, more likely to support stiff alcohol licensing laws, and even to have been brought up believing in temperance than middle-class conservatives. Two of the most dogged opponents of abortion law reform were the Mahon brothers, Labour MPs from Merseyside. Nobody saw anything strange with this. Labour's working class base was also its conservative foundation. Working class socialists at the time were at one with the middle class on the need for good behaviour. All were intensely law-abiding, orderly, and respectable. End quote. Standard working class socialist fare from 1900, right up until late 1960, would today be considered deeply conservative and reactionary, and be spat on in the halls of the Labour Party conference as the dreaded Blue Labour. Even in the halls of the Tory Party conference, many of these issues, such as abortion, are considered beyond the pale. The political soul of old-style working-class socialism has been put into a category of the politically unspeakable, making the big bad working-class man something of a political untouchable. He is no longer placated in the modern political landscape by promises of handouts from the state and hollow tub thumping around soaking some imaginary capitalist class to pay their bills for them. He is disconnected from his traditional values utterly when it comes to political representation. He wants his town back. He wants to live in a country he recognises. He wants his kids safe. He wants his work to be meaningful and honest. He is already a reactionary without knowing it. What we are offering is not a hard sell. Natural ideas of order and hierarchy are implicitly understood by the working man of Britain. Family, community, strength, and localism are already things that appeal to him. And we have one more ace up our sleeve in regards to the fetid, aging ruling elite who cling to power, because we do genuinely want to clear them out. Discussions around propaganda was a major theme in multiple speeches at the Witan in 2022, and its base nature should not be shied away from. If the Tory party genuinely wanted to dominate their newly conquered electoral northern territories in places like Rotherham, their adverts attacking their rivals would not be akin to the infamous Labour isn't working or Labour's going for broke again. They would be as raw and powerful as saying a packy raped your daughter because Labour let them in. There is an off-the-record comment I've heard multiple times from people who've had political careers of some form or another, that any party that promised to hang all the nonces would capture the native British working class vote completely overnight. But of course, doing so would lead to a crucifixion in the media, along with the Electoral Commission and parliamentary standards bodies crippling any political party who did make this a line of campaigning. In a democracy, you aren't allowed to say things that genuinely appeal to people on a base level. De-intellectualising and stripping down complex ideas is not a low pursuit. It is one of the most difficult things to do and expresses a high degree of maturity of those ideas. Our ideas, our logos, must be capable of being distilled down to their purest essence in order to stir action and create praxis. We cannot wring our hands about oversimplification when appealing to different audiences, nor should we be worried about fairness, especially towards our enemies. They are a class of people who have already singled us out as an existential enemy to be utterly destroyed. If we are to appeal to the working class, non-ruling elite, the big baz, the lion, we must be simple, decisive, and confident. We must deal with truths and certainties he already knows intuitively to be reality, but that no one else is brave enough to say. Not just surface-level platitudes about rowing back the excesses of the latest phase of social degeneration, but an embodiment of that truly revolutionary spirit Bowden wanted to instill. Those trapped in the dying areas of Britain, the council estates and non-native ghettos, who are without hope, are those most primed to accept this message. Those people are the true political untouchables, portrayed as feckless, racist, useless, lower than the immigrant who will work for pennies an hour to boost our sacred GDP. Those people have truly been betrayed. Even the regime media acknowledges they have been relegated to an educational underclass, but are sneered at for the conditions that are imposed on them. Their anger is the most raw, and their hatred of the current order the most ingrained. We are often accused of representing the politics of hate, but this is something we should not disavow. Hatred for the conditions we and our countrymen find ourselves in are not something to shy away from. I hate what Britain has become, what it is still becoming, and I hate those who are deliberately transforming it for their own gain. Portraying politics as a class war between the native British population and a class of disloyal elites who are quite literally sacrificing the well-being of the nation's children for their political projects is incredibly powerful, and above all, it is true. This kind of rhetoric is politically unthinkable, despite the fact it would be ruthlessly effective, because you cannot put that kind of English working class rage back in the bottle. If fed and harnessed, it would lead to the utter destruction of the current order, and so there is an agreement between the supposedly bitter enemies within the political parties to never utilise that power. The massive advantage any truly distant movement would have is that it can promise, in no uncertain terms, to make the enemies of the native British working class man suffer greatly. That impulse requires neither nuance nor finesse. It is pure praxis. The anger in Britain is raw. It is a perpetually open wound that has not found a satisfactory outlet or voice. A lid has been placed over it, and all we need do is remove it. But as our good friend Panama Hat pointed out in his speech last year, a lumbering body of praxis is nothing without a head to guide it. An immense strength is simply wasted in an orgy of unfocused, violent action. Chapter 6. Body and Mind. In the immediate term, though, this is all just logos, it's all just talk, it's all just theory. I do appreciate the irony of advocating for pure praxis through the medium of an essay of logos, as it is clear thought must precede action. But action must inevitably come, lest the nascent distant movement be relegated to a head in a jar. There is a dearth of praxis, a paralysis many feel in the distant space around the idea of action, or even what action would be. We should less be looking at logos versus praxis in the adversarial sense, but looking at them as a yin and yang to be kept in balance. And to their credit, most of the speakers at the Witan did do this to some degree. Let us then move to the world of theory and examine how the native working class anger of modern Britain interfaces with the Juvenalian model of power. First, a brief explanation. The Juvenal divides power distribution into three areas: primary, secondary, and periphery or tertiary, or high, middle, and low. The primary power centre, which he refers to as capital P power, is where sovereignty is held. It is the home of the ruling elite. The secondary power centre, the middle, is made up of subordinate organs of state. The rival non-ruling power centres, such as the police, the bureaucracy, and much of the management organs of the government. They hold power, but do not hold sovereignty. The periphery, the low, are the masses who do not exercise or wield institutional power. This is where the British working class reside. In his book Nemesis, C.A. Bond discusses the model in relation to the periphery in an easily understandable way. To quote, "At times, it is this power which aligns with the periphery as a means to strengthen itself and weaken the subsidiary power centres. At other times, it is the subsidiary power centres which engage with the periphery to undermine and overtake the primary power centre. Whatever section is aligned with this periphery, it should be noted that without this alliance between a power centre and the periphery is itself basically irrelevant. Without the assistance of a power centre, any action by the periphery is, by virtue of lacking institutional embodiment and political protection, at best sporadic and ineffective. A popular protest, rebellion, or any other form of dissenting action by the periphery if it has no support from an element of the power structure, will quickly fade into irrelevance. This model provides a good explanation of why this anger has failed to boil over despite its ubiquity in modern Britain. There is no secondary power centre willing to ally with the distant working class despite its immense size. Within traditional leftist models, the periphery is made up of some invocation of the proletariat working class, such as the trade union members and other labour organisations. Modern British trade unions are now fully on board with all aspects of the regime programme to the degree that they do not object to the dilution of the labour market via mass immigration. The supposed periphery the current power centre reaches down to is an illusory one. It is in fact made up of activists from secondary power centres such as NGOs, political interest groups, large charities, universities, think tanks and others that parrot its own rhetoric back at them. The only peripheral group the current power centre does genuinely reach down to are recent immigrants. Even the supposedly oppressed racial and sexual minorities have long been folded into the secondary power structure once they become established in the UK. This goes some way to explaining why mass immigration is so important. A constant stream of violent migrants are a group that can be used to threaten any native population of Britain if they do not go along with the ruling class. This is why talk of deportation is met with talk of riots. What this means is that they put themselves deliberately at odds with every non-elite, non-regime native British person. This is where self-preservation has begun to take over, but political hegemony has stopped it from taking an organised shape. This is where we come in. Demystifying distant action to mobilise the genuinely dispossessed native working class is the path to effective action once a toehold in a secondary power structure has been achieved, once the vanguard has succeeded in some way. We cannot view the anger of our countrymen, our kin, as a utilitarian object to be wielded, or with the anthropological disassociation the modern intellectual class views it with. Rudyard Kipling's The Beginnings speaks its infamous line, "When the Englishman began to hate." In that poem, it is a silent, slow, but justified hatred, growing reluctantly but inexorably in the ordinary man. It will not swiftly abate. We are not fomenting this sentiment. We are merely giving it an avenue to be resolved. To do so, we must be genuine in our belief and earnest in our actions. The only way to build that bridge is through personal relationships and community building. It is done through a form of evangelism and creates a permanent group identity rather than a transitory mob. Radical Liberation spoke of the growth of the early church in his speech as an example of this, and Panama Hat spoke of the infectious logos that enabled the spread of ideas. Those ideas are best spread in natural community hubs we have remaining, the pubs, the social clubs, the hobby groups. Jonathan Bowden's immortal chant of "clear them out" has most often been shouted whilst holding a pint in a pub full of people also holding pints. He was a man whose legacy mostly consists of poorly recorded pub backroom speeches that are nevertheless hoarded and poured over today like rare Beatles bootlegs. Perhaps this time, time shall count for the date that Baz began to hate. Outreach to the political periphery is a bridge we need to be consciously building now. And alliances are already in place if the full apparatus of praxis is to be there when it is needed. Hatred of the ruling class and the intellectual class by the working class is seen as a permanent feature of the British social order. But in Britain, that is simply not true. Residual love for the crown stretching back centuries still remains and is one of the last cohesive forces in modern British society. The pale shadow of past nationalism was called upon during the Diamond Jubilee, the death of the Queen, and the coronation, briefly clothing the Avonlian ashes of Britain in a sea of pound shop union flags and 50s-style street parties. There is genuine love for those who are seen to rule by right and not merely by might. And the only right the current order can call on are the tattered ideals of democracy and submitting to popular will. even if it means your own destruction. As we continue to see, this invocation of popular will is false, as the popular will of Britain would seem to be shut the borders. We are currently a movement of artists, poets, philosophers, intellectuals, writers and scholars, with a smattering of engineers, business people and finance people thrown in. We should not shy away from our elitist and hierarchical instincts, but instead harness them to create a pathway from outer to inner circles that requires genuine commitment and talent. To do this, we need to add the practical skills and the natural leadership skills of the British working class and tap into their immense stock of strong, committed, and well-rooted men. It is not a performative reaching down, but a making whole of a tribe scattered by those who seek to undermine the very idea of Britain and the ancient communities that make it up. Ancient communities that all of us who are British come from. Thank you. Hopefully I didn't stumble too much there. Again, that was a speech I wrote to be presented at the 2022 Witan event. I also believe it was supposed to be in a book that I'm pretty sure never came out. I certainly never received a copy of it anyway. But here it is. Despite some slight clumsiness, because it's quite hard to parse some of those ideas in a way that is, legal. Despite some of the weirdness of phrasing, I hope that it got its message across, and I hope that people can see the value in reaching out to and essentially filtering parts of the British working class to find potential natural leaders. That's really the thrust of the speech. If you want to donate to us, you can do so on Ko-fi. Please do check out the Anti-Politics Substack, on which this was also published. Thank you once again for 1,000 subscribers over on Substack. Have yourselves a good evening, and I'll speak to you next time. Goodbye.